Good morning. Open our Senate Revenue Committee for the last day in May. So we were closed for a week. We're back open, I think, all this week, and I presume we'll just keep working on bills. We have a number of House bills that we need to work on, and then a few Senate bills that we're waiting until there's some form of budgetary agreement. And when that comes, we'll hopefully have enough time to move out some of the tax credit bills that we haven't, that we would like to do in the Senate. Let's go. Let's do 427 first on the formula, and then do 2237, then 2511. That'll open a work session on Senate Bill 427. And Steve, we have what, a dash 3 and 5?
Mr. Chair, members, you have a dash 3 and a dash 4. Mm-hmm. At the last meeting on the bill, you were dealing with an issue sheet that I'd prepared for you that had some questions about the high-cost disability grant, the small high school supplement fund, and then whether that would be something to deal with an interim review of the formula. The dash 3 has the high-cost disability grant continuing permanently, and it would still have the $25,000 floor, so it would apply to costs above the $25,000 per eligible high-cost disability student. So that would be as it is currently in practice. The change on the high-cost disability grant was to increase the annual total amount that could be allocated through that grant to raise the $12 million to $17 million. Okay. So those are the changes then on the high-cost disability grant. The dash 3 does not have any language in it that would continue this small high school supplement fund, the $2.5 million per year to the small high school districts. The dash 4 has the same language on the high-cost disability grant, $25,000 and $17 million. But the dash 4 would extend the small high school supplement fund for two more years. So it makes an appropriation of $2.5 million for each of the next 2 years. That's the only difference between the dash 3 and the dash 4. It deals with the small high school supplement fund. And those were the two requests for amendments to deal with those two issues. And then the third issue is what, if anything, the committee wants to do for an interim review of the school equalization formula. It depends upon how formal or informal you would like that process to be. I would just like to mention that the chalkboard project, I've learned, is doing a review of the formula. I'm not sure what form or how detailed that might be, but they will probably make some recommendations in terms of the formula needs changing, and probably needs changing in these areas, but not be specific, or they may be more specific in terms of saying that the formula should take a different format or a different approach to equalization, and it should be along these lines. So that remains to be determined in terms of how that will play out. It could be just be a work group of an interim revenue committee process, which could make it more or less formal and not require perhaps a separate appropriation. It could just be any cost that would be anticipated could be part of the interim revenue committee budget process. Or it could be part of this bill or part of a separate bill legislatively setting up a task force.
What did you put together, Steve, in the dash 5s? I know we don't have them, but...
Well, I have a dash 5, but it's not complete. I would prefer to hand out an outline that kind of summarizes the topics that would be dealt with in the potential dash 5. This is maybe more than I thought in front of that. What's envisioned here is kind of two different groups. One, a policy group with various people appointed to it, and then a more technical or working group to help support that policy group. I initially set it up to have 12 members on in this outline, two appointed by the Speaker, two by the Senate President, one by the Governor, two school district superintendents appointed by the State Superintendent, one ESD superintendent appointed by the State Superintendent, and then one member from each of those four organizations listed there. Could be smaller, could be larger, could be appointed in a different way, but that's was a starting point that I thought might be somewhat reasonable and representative. Then the technical advisory group had nine members potentially, two from the Department of Education, two from Legislative Revenue, one from Exec, perhaps a business official, and then three outside volunteers that at least one perhaps from higher education that has some that's worked in school finance issues or would have a strong interest in that from perhaps from one of the education departments from higher ed, and then a couple others that have a very good knowledge of school finance and school finance theory that would be willing to volunteer their time and expertise. Under the purpose of the policy group, then it would be basically to evaluate the formula and the principles used to develop that formula, and given the information and new data we have now, to make some kind of determination as to what changes should be made into that formula, and then also to evaluate whether those principles should be changed and whether the formula should basically take a new tack and be done in a different way based upon some changes or modifications to the current principles that are used kind of as the foundation for the formula, and then perhaps work up a concept of their view of school finance equity that would then be developed into a formula or a modified formula. So it's basically going through that whole process and trying to then devise a formula or a modified current formula if as they see fit. The technical group is just basically there to provide data and advice and options to the policy group.
So, Steve, when's the last time we had this kind of exhaustive look and reexamination of our school finance formula?
Well, nothing in this detail since 1990, mm-hmm. when the change was made. And that was a rather informal process that occurred during the session. Mm-hmm. 91 session. So it wasn't anything formal like this. And then if you go this formal route, then you have the problem of, do you need an administrator? Do you need a budget? Mm-hmm. What kind of report is required? Mm-hmm. And voting, how do you adopt recommendations? And all of those kinds of administrative details that would have to be addressed. Mm.
Well, what do folks think? I like the idea of an exhaustive look at the formula. I think it's time to do it. I'm not sure. Senator Starr.
Well, I like the idea as well, but I think perhaps we've already initiated an exhaustive look through the chalkboard project, which may provide us some guidance. Maybe it's premature to start on a separate track. I would like to hear from folks from the education community, see what their thinking is. But personally, having been involved in hearings on turning the chalkboard project down a different avenue through our education committee, I think that at least we should consider what the experts have to tell us about this proposal. I'm not ready right now to move forward with that idea.
Are there other thoughts? So do folks want to come up and talk So the three ideas, we got the dash threes, dash fours, and dash fives. Just wave your hand if you'd like to. There's one, there's two. Okay, so Lori and Chuck and...
And the dash fives is the draft outlook.
Oh, that's true. They're not even... It would be the idea of having some sort of task force, which I kind of agree with Senator Starr, is that maybe we can hope the chalkboard project, outside of the political process, really gives us that.
Steve, could you tell us on the chalkboard project, who makes up that group? I mean, what interest...
I do not know who will be on the finance review group. I've heard that Jim Scherzinger will chair it, but I can't confirm that.
As to who, what parties, I mean, what groups are actually represented within the Trump?
I don't know.
Okay.
Do you guys know?
Mr. Chairman, Chuck Bennett, representing the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. My recollection, Mr. Chairman, is that it's made up of, it's financed by the, what, four or five largest foundations in the state, and that's the funding.
Okay, so like Meyer Foundation,
Meyer and
Ford, or who else?
Geldwin.
Of course,
calling
up my Geldwin.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, again, Chuck Bennett, regarding first the dash three and dash four amendments. Mr. Chairman, we would prefer, if I recall correctly, the dash four amendments that include the small school supplement fund. Mr. Chairman, as you know, one of the continuing challenges in Oregon is how to keep small school districts afloat, particularly small school districts with small high schools. This has been a successful program. Certainly another two-year program. We would prefer to just see the program go along with the high-cost disabilities as an ongoing fund, but given that we'll very clearly be discussing the formula in its entirety, whether the chalkboard or working groups or a task force take it on, I'm sure the issue will come up. Small school districts with small high schools continue to rely on this as a portion of their funding source to keep these districts keep these schools afloat. In any state that has the distribution of population the way Oregon does, you've got to ask yourselves how we keep these small towns going, particularly when we don't have mills in these small towns or other kinds of industrial infrastructure. And one of the ways you do it is keep their school district going, and this has been a tremendous help. We'd ask you to continue this program, certainly make it part of any interim study. In terms of the dash fives, I think whenever you have a discussion with something as sensitive as the formula, our organization, like any other organization, would like to be party, and of course the task force as described here allows us to be party to the discussion. But we also understand that there will be ample opportunity for our organization or any other organization, and we will participate in any kind of structure that you all are listening to. We'd prefer to be at the table. This offers us an opportunity to be at the table, but if you're going, the discussion is going to occur. There's no question the House is looking at the same issue. You all are interested in this issue. It's been 15 years since this has been really looked at. As Steve described, it really was put together during the session. It's time to take another look. There are elements that we think need some changes or some more care in the way funds are distributed. So we anticipate that discussion will occur one way or the other. A formalized task force just gives us a clearer opportunity to be at the table. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Bennett? Senator George.
Just a comment. On Friday night, we're at Alpine, at a little community that was once a beautiful, thriving little place, and I pulled up and parked across from the school, former school, and which is now just a community center. And I thought, you know, this was the last of the community, was the school, and now that's completely shut down. And it was nice to have a community center, but it was also just a really adorable school setting. And this is a real problem. Once that leaves the community, then you notice that the grocery store was closed, and this was closed, and that was closed, and everything else. The community basically disappeared. It's now, I suppose, folks are driving out from places like Eugene to live out there because it is very beautiful. But the school is gone. That was the focal point. That was the linchpin for the community. And we need to make sure, that's what they're like we say with the Dash 4, we can maintain something. I mean, nothing's going to revive that school. It's gone now. But that's happening everywhere in the state.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I saw that happen up in Detroit, just 50-some miles east of town here. And the same thing, school closed, district consolidated, school closed and became a community center. And it really changes the nature of a community to lose its school. And fortunately for Detroit and probably for Alpine, they were able to move their children to districts closer, larger, and close enough to at least bus them, in the case of Detroit, down to Mill City. But many of the districts affected by the Dash 4 amendments don't have that option. There really isn't a closer district for them. And it's a real problem, and one we hope we can address further during the interim. But at least on the short term, we hope you'll pass the Dash 4s.
So just on the Dash 4s, by saying yes to that, in some ways, and I know, and Steve, you may want to talk about the other ways that we address smaller schools and towns that are affected by it. But to me, and Chuck, agree or disagree, that in some ways implicit in that decision of taking $5 million out of the formula and setting it aside, in some ways, we are saying yes to one, but we are saying no to and exacerbating what is already an inequitable situation where you have, whether it's Sherwood or pick a district that receives so much less, and this would just make it that much more less within the school funding formula. And so by saying yes in that scenario and maybe forcing a discussion that is a tough one, and that's why I go back and forth on this whole task force because the formula is just so difficult, but to me, every time you do that, and we've done it several times, and we can talk about the different ways, in so many different ways, you're just you're saying no to one, and or yes to one, and then no to another community, and exacerbating what is already, what at least from my vantage point, some real inequities where one district has $47,000 per student, and one is at $5,000 or $6,000 per student.
Yeah. Ms. Chairman, you're certainly correct, and it's something that will be discussed, I think, during the interim. But I think to try to compare the scope of a district the size of Sherwood with its issues, and there's no, I don't think anyone argues that Sherwood has a unique situation, but to compare that to a smaller school district with a single small high school, I think you have to have just a certain amount of money to put on the show. And that's the problem in these small districts, is just reaching that level that you can offer a basic education, that you can meet the needs of what are admittedly very small populations. And this is an attempt, and it may be imperfect, and we'll find out as we discuss it further, but it's an attempt to keep those schools open. That is not the problem Sherwood faces. The question of equity for Sherwood is a question of equity and a question of distribution of funds. For a community with a small high school, it goes far beyond that. They just don't, because of their low populations, don't meet the funding threshold to offer a complete education. This assists them in that, and so do other programs.
So what other weighting factors do we have to help out a district within the formula that would help a district like Alpine out? Low property value.
You certainly, in a district like Alpine or a place like Alpine, you'd have poverty. There'd be no question about that. Once you close the mill, you're going to be pretty much guaranteed poverty.
So you get that weighting.
And you could certainly have social factors that it could include pregnant students. I mean, all the other ones. I mean, the ones that we know on top of it. I can't, off the top of my head, I can't think of within that. Steve may have a better answer. But it would be the standard weighting factors. What they don't probably have special education students or a population that would guarantee them those funds, because that population tends to migrate to where there are other services available along with education services. So this is, you know, pretty much limited to probably poverty in the small school fund to assist these.
Mr. Chair, you also have the small school correction factor, which gives extra weight for small elementary schools and small high schools. It's just a matter that the small high school supplement fund is additional money generated along with the small high school weight. And so it's kind of an addition of funds to, again, allow an opportunity for a more complete offering of subjects and having somewhat comparable opportunities at the small high school level that you would find at a larger high school.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Chuck, help me with it. Well, Sherwood is a classic example, I think, of what's happening in some high-growth areas. You have values of property there are just skyrocketing. You have brand-new development with very, very nice homes. You have brand-new retail operations going in. That has to have a significant impact on the tax base that they have available to them under Measure 47 and 50. Could you guys help me? Because it seems to me like that's kind of a self-solving problem.
Go ahead, Lori.
Mr. Chair and committee members, for the record, Lori Wimmer Whalen, representing the Oregon Education Association. I wish it were true that the pace of growth paid for itself, but we have not found in precipitously fast-growing areas that to be the case. It certainly contributes, mm-hmm. but dollar for dollar, the studies that I've seen suggest that growth does not pay for itself in terms of infrastructure, including education. And so you'd end up with those pressures because you can't build a school fast enough in some of those communities to accommodate that growth. Beaverton is another example, of course, where about the time that a school gets built and the doors open, they're already at capacity. So,
other thoughts or questions? I can't tell, Senator George.
I really support the idea of continuing this small school grant. I believe that it is important. It's significant to the small schools, but relatively insignificant in the overall school budget. I just feel like that we probably should be listening and moving the -4 amendments.
And Steve, on that, can we get a listing of who receives the small high school and what their appropriation is?
We have that.
Mm-hmm.
One of those runs that Steve did for us.
Mr. Chair, yes, the run that I handed out, excuse me, at the last meeting had the small high school listed, but that was run at a different high-cost disability amount. If you would like something more comparable to the -4.
So, and does this break out who would be the recipients of this $5 million? Yes, it does.
Yes, it does.
And, Lori, as we pass this out, I never... Please.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, again for your record. Lori Wimmer Whalen. Just some generalized comments about these. We, too, support the -4 and think that it's a good compromise to extend the sunset another 2 years with the understanding that some sort of review of the distribution formula might be a good idea. One of the things I like to say about that is... And don't laugh. I know I'm a one-note tune on this, but I think that the pressures that we see in these different areas with different kinds of problems coping with money has to do, those are symptoms. The illness that we're all grappling with really is, of course, the quantity of money that's available to run the school systems around the state. And we feel that we do not have an adequate level of funding. And so what happens when you have an inadequate supply of revenue? avenue for K-12 is that everyone scrambles for the crumbs in their own way, and the distribution formula reflects those pains. And we think that distribution is a policy issue in and of itself because it has to do with fairness, and it has to do with being able to manage in a more predictable way uncontrollable costs. Rather than being a place where policy choices such as what level of program you offer and so on might be engaged. So we think that a review of the distribution formula not only would help us figure out what all needs to be in there and whether or not we're adequately describing what those uncontrollable cost factors are, but also so that we can elevate the discussion once again so that we can be all reminded what the distribution formula is and, more importantly, what it is not, what it is not supposed to be. It doesn't create money. It simply distributes money. And we'd like to make sure that we have a clear understanding with the public at large, with 90 members of the legislature, and so on. And I think that a review might help us be reminded of those facts. And I also think that there may be some uncontrollable cost drivers that have been left off the table and might help us fine-tune, if you will, in a fair way, that distribution formula. So we would support some sort of review, whether it's a formalized task force or something a little less formal, and we welcome the opportunity to be at the table.
Do you think we need a formalized task force? It's just every bone in my body says don't create some task force that does.
Mr. Chair,
such difficult issues. We're going to go through it here on this small high school one, which I can tell that I'm at odds with the members of my committee. I just don't see the rationale for it, given all the other things that we do for these schools. But that's the nature of this discussion, which makes the whole notion of a task force, to me, you just recreate it in another, and maybe that's the best place to do it. So,
well, Mr. Chair, we agree that it doesn't need to be formalized. If a small work group were put together, we would certainly devote our staff time to helping look at that and scrutinize it in as policy pure a way as possible. Our goal as an association, of course, is the well-being of students across the state, not in any particular community. So there are legitimate arguments in every community for every different kind of problem, and they all have to cope with how to keep their school doors open and offer good program and give opportunity and hope to children. I mean, that's the goal. And how we get there is where we tend to have these little fights. And so we would be willing to participate even if it's an informal arrangement. I would like to say, though, that I'd like not to see that offloaded to a private foundation kind of thing. And we did an analysis of their last review as part of something they contracted with a private consultant.
The Chalkboard Project?
Yes, and I'd be happy to provide to the committee our analysis of that review. We think that we probably would like to see it be a little bit more of a quasi-public process rather than a privatized one.
And I'm just not familiar. Is it going really well, the Chalkboard Project undertaking of this? Are they just getting going?
Well, I think, Mr. Chairman, that they are going full steam ahead. I think there are certainly debatable issues that have come out. I think one of the ongoing discussions has been where their focus will be, what would be of most assistance to public education coming from their unique perspective. We're all, I think, awaiting each time there's a work product, and of course we're like every other organization or group of organizations or interests. We look at it through the prism of our special interests. But I think, as Lori said, the hope would be that this discussion of the distribution formula would occur in public forum as much as possible, and that is not always the case. Despite the town hall meetings, when the policy discussion gets down to it, they are not as public a body, certainly as the legislature is. It doesn't allow us the opportunity to comment as easily as it is to comment to the legislature. Of course,
might be a good thing on the formula. You might need that. Other questions or thoughts Got the dash threes, dash four, Senator George.
Just really quickly, Chuck, I just want to clarify. Multnomah County is a big winner in the dash four formula, and that is primarily because they have such a high population of high-cost students. Is that correct? Or?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. They are the center of population for high-cost disability students for all the reasons I talked about earlier in terms of other services provided in the community.
I just wanted to get that on the record because in case anyone thought that that was the area was getting shorted, there's big numbers headed that direction.
Big numbers there, but I think as you look at how it's distributed, it really arrives where these high cost
where the needs
are.
Absolutely. Right. Thank you.
Other thoughts? Yes, Senator Brzezinski.
Mr. Chair, I also support the dash fours. I understand the concern I think the Chair has, but I think what we're looking at is maintaining some continuity that we currently have. While we have whatever projects or work groups move forward. My concern about the Dash 5s or the proposal of having a task force is I guess one of the speakers brought it up, but I'm not sure who is the members of the chalkboard. I understand who is funding
the foundations, mm-hmm.
But the question is who's the participants, what are their expertise, and what is their perspective on what they're going to bring to the table? And I think it's great that they're doing it. I think it's great to have the outside entity giving a perspective, but I don't think we should shirk our responsibility in having something done within this body at the same time. The only concern I have is when I look at the potential policy group membership and looking at who is represented and maybe who's not represented, it's one group that appears that's not is the classified workers of the public school system, OSEA, and it would seem to me that they should be at that table because they have a perspective within the public school sector. And I'm not sure when I look at this, we have the proposal of two school district superintendents from different size of districts, one ESD superintendent, and then you have one of each of the four that are listed. And if we want to keep it a working group of 12, potentially we could and I don't know, the AD of ESD, that's an association for the ESDs?
How about we do this on the Dash 5s, because here's my thought now that I think about this a little bit, is not do some formal task force,
okay.
Which forces people because of the mandate of law, but maybe we'll have the revenue chairs as they sit down and look at the interim committee, talk to the chalkboard project, see where they're at, see what is coming out of that, and then find a way to build in this public process that is painful but necessary to build that into the chalkboard project and just work closely with them on whatever recommendations. And you have funding available for those interim committees and maybe just do it a little less formal. Mm-hmm. But how's that sound?
That would be fine if we can be assured that it's going to be a public process and you're going to allow people at the table and not just a select number, whatever that might be. I don't know. It's all in abstract right now from my perspective because I don't know who's been invited and what their mission is really going to be as to how broad of a review are they going to do and stuff like that. I think it's a cooperative between private nonprofit and the state of Oregon and our setting would be fine.
So Steve and Paul, who will kind of ride herd over this in 3 weeks or a month or 2 months or whenever that term actually begins. I agree with those sentiments, is that we would make this somewhat of a priority, talk to whoever the House Chair is of the Interim Committee and just build a working relationship with the Chalkboard Project and see if they have any product that we could actually start working on. Since I would believe it'd be a legislative recommendation, whatever they come up with is just going to be a recommendation to the legislature unless it's and they'd be crazy to do this, some sort of initiative on the formula. Oh boy, Paul. This is rarity. Paul is
volunteering to come forward.
What's really happening? No, Paul Warner, let's say Revenue Office. I have talked with the Chalkboard Project, talked with Jim Scherzinger, and in fact, they Sue Hildick has approached the House Speaker's office and asked for use of some of our time in the interim. So I, of course, volunteered Steve. So, we're starting the coordination point at this stage. We haven't really done anything with them, but they have expressed interest in working with Legislative Revenue Office and with the legislature.
Yeah. Okay, that's good to know. The only caveat with them is there hasn't been a lot of products. I mean, these are thorny issues that we're all well aware of, and they've been at it for a few years, and I haven't seen a lot of production. But you can say the same about us. So.
Mr. Chair, yes. Maybe part of this would be finding out what their time frame is and as to what they're going to attempt to encompass within their work project, and then you as the interim chair could actually maybe refocus us if necessary to take a more active role within our process to kind of move some stuff. It seems like they're not really going to be on a time schedule that's going to be productive. Because your point's well taken. I mean, we need to look at this. It's been since 1990, and come in 2 years when we come into session 07, we should be ready to make whatever adjustments and changes and not have to wait another 2 years for something to happen.
Yeah. Once you're in session, you're within a narrow framework of what you're going to do. Any other thoughts on this? Thank you. Anyone else on this? Okay, so I'm going to close the work session. I hear the committee saying they like the dash threes and the dash fours. I like the dash threes. And let me think about
Mr. Chair, what I heard was three members say they like the dash fours, one member who just actually has the gavel say that he likes the dash threes.
So I'm going to spend some time thinking about these dash fours. And
while we're on the subject, Mr.
If
Chair,
we can put it up for Thursday, posted it whenever our 48 hours is. So we'll return to this and on Thursday. Yes, Senator Pozanski.
Mr. Chair, I noticed that there's a little item in front of each of our desks, and I just have one question. Is it dark, milk, or white?
Oh, on the chocolates. Because I'm not a chocolate eater. I don't know. But I have a ton of chocolate sitting up in my office.
There was a special request that said that you should not be coming back in the building unless you brought in dark chocolate.
Noted. And there is plenty of... Feel free to come to my office. It's been a lot of Swiss francs on chocolate on Monday or on Sunday. So if you're not satisfied, please come up and we'll see what we've got. Okay, so we'll close the work session on... Thank you, Steve.
You're welcome.
On Senate Bill 427. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2237. Mazin.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Welcome back.
No.
Even though I didn't see any chocolate here. I'm not saying a word until I get chocolate.
There you go.
Okay. Now I can talk. Okay. House Bill 2237. It is a bill that deals with the issue of the Lottery Commission and the disputes and resolution of those disputes. It puts in process an obligation for the lottery to go through dispute resolution process rather than different ways of dealing with issues that raise when it comes to retailers of the lottery. This builds in an existing law of the dispute resolution process that is in ORS 183.502, and I included that in your SMS for your reference to see how that process works in the current law. And it specifies Portland State University with the Hatfields, Marco Hatfield School of Government, Department of Justice, and how they go about building that kind of process into dispute resolution. However, what this bill introduces as new is that they require the lottery to do it every time, so it says shall rather than may, and that's what new in this bill. When we heard the bill in the House, that the director of the lottery submitted letters and talked a little bit about how they already handle this process in the agency and in the commission itself, and providing that they have their own processes. I can't remember if we heard anything in support of the bill, but
we don't have anyone signed off. It's pretty straightforward. Any questions on for Mazin on House Bill 2237 or thoughts? Folks ready to
Move to work session? Okay, Chair.
Good.
We're in here.
Close the public hearing. Open work session. On House Bill 2237. Senator George, did you have? I couldn't tell if you had a question or a thought. I don't.
No, I'm just shocked that they weren't in here because this seems like a pretty major change in the way you deal with a dispute. And if I were them, I'd want to keep it the way it is. But they're not here. They're not here.
I saw it was filed by the House Interim Committee, so I assume they did some work on this in the interim.
The vote from the House was 56-0.
Yeah.
Senator Starr.
Yes, I move House Bill 2237 to the floor if we do pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2237 to the floor if we do pass recommendation. Folks ready to vote on this? Any objections to that motion? Hearing none, so ordered. Senator Starr?
Yes.
Close the work session on that. Open. Thank you, Mazin.
Chocolate?
I'm out of chocolate, so Mary is
to the office.
Open a public hearing on 2511. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee. House Bill 2511A will add four organizations to the current list of fraternal organizations whose properties are exempt from property tax, subject to certain restrictions, of course. Changes the definition of a fraternal organization from one that is a nonprofit established as a lodge system from a ritualist with a ritualist form of work to one that has been established as a service system, and removes a descriptive phrases, grand and subordinate lodges of. Background on this material is that under certain entities, we do not have the current definition does not define a fraternal organization as one that is a social club, for example. It has to be established under a lodge system, and the bill, as printed here, simply takes out all of the language that previously was in the original bill that dealt with subordinate lodges of the Masons, and simply deletes that and lists the four additional names that would be added. And were it not for the addition of these particular names, they wouldn't qualify as fraternal organizations because they're service systems. They're not lodge systems with ritualistic forms of work.
And is it? It's not at the discretion of the counties or the cities.
No, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Questions for Mary? Mr. Simmons. In cities and counties, do y'all want to? Do you want to talk on this?
Sure.
Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, and
members of the committee. My name is Grover Simmons. This morning I'm representing the Oregon State Elks Association, all 45,000 of them on a Tuesday morning. Thank you for spending a little time on this bill. It's the perhaps the least monumental bill you'll be asked to consider in this session in one respect. Mary is correct in that the purpose of the bill is simply to add four organizations to the list of tax-exempt organizations. That's the Lions Club, Sir Optimus, the Rotary, and the Kiwanis. I believe that's the goal, that's the mission, to add those and to declare that they would be qualified as a tax-exempt organization. The original bill, which you don't have before you, you have a dash A amendment. You have a dash A bill. The original bill was poorly constructed, if you will, that it created a real problem. It would have flipped things on their head and created a tax on fraternal organizations. And I want to get to a second point, but may I just read the paragraph that was in the original bill. It says, all real and personal property that is owned by a fraternal organization and that is actually occupied or used by a charitable organization that qualifies for exemption from the federal income tax, because the charitable organization is an entity described in Section 501(c)(3) of the Internal Revenue Code, provided that the this is a list of exemptions. Provided that the fraternal organization does not any time during the assessment year use the property for fraternal organization purposes. I mean, that is just nonsensical. It just doesn't make sense. So the House eliminated that paragraph, period. I think it's charitable to say that it's nonsensical. Nevertheless, the bill also eliminated some language that we are concerned about. It eliminated the words the grand and subordinate lodges of. And it has that in two places, on line 21 and the second part of line 21. Well, we would respectfully ask that the amendment we're suggesting this morning, which is the A-3 amendment, puts back in the words the grand and subordinate lodges of. Those six words on line 21, because that's a part of the name of the Elks, for example. We are known as the Grand and Subordinate Lodges. It's a part of the structure of the national organization. So the bill can, the people who want this bill can accomplish their goal without tinkering with our name. Mm-hmm. And it's just as simple as that. So I signed up opposing the bill. But we have no substantive difference with these entities being added. That's a pure tax issue. But to play with our name is unnecessary. And that's the whole argument, Mr. Chairman. As I said, it's not a gigantic monumental item except to anybody but these Elks. Actually, the other organizations are affected as well. The Elks, the Moose, the Odd Fellows, they have grand and subordinate lodges, whereas the Masons do not. Representative Butler told me that the Masons, he didn't think the Masons had grand and subordinate lodges, so that language could be eliminated for them. That's why we've asked that this language on line 21, after the word Masons, be restored. And that is the whole argument, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very, very much.
Yeah, no, thank you. I didn't notice that you're signed up in opposition.
Yes. By the way, Mr. Chairman, this bill was with us 2 years ago, and it got complicated as well. And not on this particular point, but some other point. And this is left, the language that the House eliminated was left over from 2 years ago. And it just wasn't constructed nicely.
So you'd like to get language that at the very least insert your name of your organization back into statute.
Please.
Okay. Well, we'll hold off. Questions or comments? That's the only testimony we have for this, so we have no one signed up in support of the bill. But we will have this. It's not going to move if there's no one. Ms. Simmons has an amendment. there's no one here actually advocating for the bill, and so we'll let the sponsors, Mr. Simmons, if there are any, actually come and tell us why this is a good idea and give you time to amend the bill.
Thank you.
If
the bill's going forward.
If it's going to go forward, we'll give you time to have your amendments drafted.
If it were left over for two more years and came back in 07 properly constructed, yes, we'd come back in and testify in support of the bill.
Maybe we'll set up a task force.
Yeah, with designated membership. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Brzezinski.
Just for your information, if you didn't see, the A3 probably would take care of the concerns that have been raised by the Mr. Simmons. So if we are going to be moving the bill, then the A3s would be something we'd want to consider.
Great.
But it sounds to me that at this point we probably aren't going to, unless someone comes in with clear and convincing evidence.
Of why we would. Senator Starr, any thoughts?
Well, I'm for moving the bill, but we've got people out here just real anxious to come up and talk to us about it, so we ought to do that.
Oh, are, do you want to come? You had not signed up.
I don't. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I just wanted to mention that we don't have any particular concerns with this bill. It's our understanding that most of these organizations get an exemption through their charitable, through a separate statute that has to do with charitable organizations. So if you note the revenue impact, it's very, very small, and I just wanted to bring that to your attention.
So there are already, we need your name.
Michelle Deister, League of Oregon Cities, for the record.
So they're already getting this. It's just, this would make, well, this would make it, I guess, clearer for them when they're filling out their tax forms.
It's my understanding, Mr. Chair, that the majority of these organizations can apply for a charitable organization exemption. This is for those few that haven't done that. So,
yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. I'm sorry I didn't sign up. I heard someone say this would affect four organizations, and so I wanted to be sure and state that I think the line on line 20 it says includes but not limited to.
Mm-hmm.
And since the word up above in line 8 is being added, or service, the words or service,
mm-hmm,
we've administered this statute with the counties, you know, with the definitions of the ritualistic, the lodge, this and that, and service hasn't been part of that before, so I'm not sure exactly what that means. I did testify to that on the House side.
Of what that language means.
What service means. We have lists of other kinds of entities that don't currently qualify for this exemption. The Lions, the Kiwanis, Seroptimus, Rotary are included, but so are the Optimist, Master Gardeners, Labor Temples, Union Halls, and JC. So we would assume that they would also fall under service. So I just want to be sure if the testimony was that four additional would be included. I just wanted to say that we're not so sure that that's 100% accurate.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and okay, we're fine either way. It's just it's not clear what
we should know what we're getting ourselves into. Questions for Mr. Phillips?
Oh, I,
okay.
What?
Senator Brzezinski and Senator Metzger.
I guess I don't know this area well enough as to the definitions to what a fraternal organization is. I see what it says here as compared to the service organizations. It seems to me we're really opening up and allowing service organizations to somehow now be defined as fraternal. Is that a fair reading of what this would actually do, and then where they may have some exemptions through some other aspects of the tax code, they'd be in a position to have additional or double certainty that they're going to get that type of treatment?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brzezinski, I'm probably not an expert on that question, but I think the words or service would then expand it from fraternal lodge system or service, which would be another, which would to me mean that they wouldn't necessarily have to be lodge or fraternal.
Mm-hmm.
We looked up the definitions of those three, you know, lodge system, ritualistic, and fraternal under the IRS codes, because they also have to approach this question. And fraternal meant lodge system with ritualistic work, and we'd apply these are used as in federal and state definitions that have been tested in the courts on this issue. So generally, lodge system with ritualistic work. Lodge system is the what's referred to by Mr. Grover Simmons, the two levels, the grand and subordinate, are required as a minimum for the Internal Revenue Service. So the grand and subordinate, somehow a two-level system.
Okay.
and maybe someone is more expert on that than I.
Mr. Chair. No one's waving their hands.
Okay.
Senator Metzger. And then Senator Forrest.
Yeah, thank you. Is there a legal definition of service?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, not that I'm aware of in the property tax statutes.
Okay. I mean, I just think that might be something, if we're going to use that phrase to define it. I was wondering, for example, would you consider the Chamber of Commerce, like North Clackamas Chamber of Commerce has their own building, would that be, they consider themselves a service organization, would that qualify for that building then, or in the absence of a definition, maybe they could make that case it would be?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, I think that's what our concern was, and that is also, I didn't list that, but with the Master Gardeners, the Chamber is also on that list of ones that don't currently qualify under this provision. So they may, as you say, they may. It's a good case to be made.
I just say, Mr. Chair, I have no problem with adding these groups, but I think we should define it to make sure that we are including only those that we have decided to include, or we're going to be back next session trying to clean it up or take away something from somebody, which would be even worse.
It's just hard to do once you're given a property tax exemption.
Exactly.
Don't try to take that away. Senator George.
Well, that was part of my question, but and I'm going to ask both of you and look at Grover, if we remove the bracketed out the words for service and included the dash threes, I mean, Grover, did that, because that would put us that consistent with federal definitions.
We need to. Sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you. I'm not his head, but.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Grover Simmons. In my view, that would restore the system. Certainly, that takes care of the Elks and all these other specified ones. A cleaner bill would be just simply to name the entities you want to add to the tax to the list of tax exemptions. That's the four, which are on line 24 and 25. That's a cleaner way to go.
Yeah.
You don't get bogged down in the word service.
Yeah.
Our amendment doesn't do our A-3 amendment or -A3 amendment is doesn't do that. It just simply restores the language, just restores those words that I was concerned about. But it would be a cleaner bill, as Senator Perkins-Sansky points out.
Mm-hmm. I agree,
Mr. Chair, yes. Members of the committee. The or service in there without the specification that Grover mentions would almost certainly require us to ask for legal advice, and we would go down that road. So there's more expenses to follow.
That's true. Yeah. DOJ.
I think Mr. Simmons' suggestion is a good one. It's just for our purposes, we'll define fraternal organization, by fiat to include those groups and solve all the other issues.
I completely agree. Anything else? Don't want to end the fun on 2511 early here. Okay, close the work public hearing on 2511, and we are adjourned. One comment. So I put up for Thursday.